I mean, this stuff is very much exposed, right? I mean, a substation might have a fence around it, but it's not that hard to find, and it's not that hard to target with a long gun, you know. And it's usually a substation, I can't say this for certain, but a substation attack, there's been that's usually what sort of makes the news if you're talking about a targeted attack on electric infrastructure. And the industry has been trying to do more to safeguard these facilities, but like, you know, to put a concrete dome over all these things, you can't do that.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original, proudly presented by Montana Knife Company. Today's episode is about the reporting of Catherine Blunt on the vulnerability of the power grid, specifically her extensive writing on the power, gas, and electric companies, better known as PG&E, in California, and their connection to the deadliest wildfire in California history and attacks on the power grid. Catherine is a Wall Street Journal reporter and author of California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric, and What It Means for America's Power Grid, which is a national bestseller and winner of the 2022 Golden Poppy Award for nonfiction. Her coverage of PG&E and the wildfire in California made her a finalist for the 2020 Pulitzer Prize. She's also the winner of the Gerald Loeb Award, which is the highest honor in business journalism. For those of you that may not know, the 2018 Camp Fire was the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California's history, and the year's most expensive natural disaster in the world in terms of insured losses. The Camp Fire killed 85 people, injured 12 civilians and 5 firefighters, causing an estimated $16.5 billion in damages. It destroyed the towns of Paradise and Cancow in California. Maybe a good way to unpack it would be to describe how our power grid in the U.S. actually grew to the point where it is today. And then we could focus maybe more narrowly on the West Coast and PG&E.
Sure. So, the grid in general was built. I mean, this kind of goes back to like Thomas Edison and Tesla and Westinghouse and like developing first power plants and distribution lines to serve cities. I mean, you saw that with Thomas Edison's Pearl Street plants in the, I can't remember the exact year, but we're talking like very early 1900s. And then efforts to build transmission.
Those first power plants or power stations, we're talking a matter of miles. I mean, this wasn't something that was spanning states, right? When Edison.
Exactly.
You could see the factory down the block and your light bulb was on, but that was like the distance that it could push power.
That's right. And I think if I recall correctly, Edison's first power plant, I think, served 86 customers in like the financial district of New York. And so, I mean, it's very small. And so in order to have a power plant built outside of a crowded population center and be able to transmit that power over a longer distance, you need high voltage transmission, which was, it took a little while to develop that in the scheme of things. But so now we have a network that, you know, starts with a power plant that's usually built, again, outside of a major city, outside of a major population area. You have a high voltage transmission wire that's kind of akin to a highway, right? Moving a lot of electrons over a long distance. And then you have substations, which step down that voltage so that it can be distributed to homes and businesses through smaller power lines, kind of akin to a network of local streets. And transmission in particular, especially on the West Coast, there are aspects of that system that are very, very old. There were large transmission networks built in the sort of the 1910s, 1920s in California and other parts of the West to support hydroelectric development, one of our earliest sort of clean, cheap forms of power. And that has major consequences for PG&E and other utilities in the West. Certainly, there was continued growth when you think, throughout certainly the first part of the century, but especially after World War II because of the population boom. So then you have other elements of the grid built out at that time. But now we're a ways out from that, right? And a lot of these power lines or power plants or substations or whatever, 40, 50 year assets. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to be upgraded or replaced in full.
So when you say that some of this equipment, whether it's the line or the production itself, meets the end of its service life, is it still capable of being used? The risk just astronomically goes through the roof?
Yeah, just trying to determine what risk it poses. There's a number of variables that influence that. How well has it been maintained over time? Have there been aspects of it that have been replaced to the point where its life has been extended? If we're talking about a power line, has it been exposed to the elements for decades on end without careful inspection? If we're talking about a power plant, has it just run too many cycles, right? Has it just been used too much and it's becoming more vulnerable to breakdown? Careful maintenance can certainly make it so that an asset can be relied upon for longer. But if that's been lacking at any point, you do face certain risks of failure, whether that be, not having electricity supply or not being able to get the power where it needs to go. Or in the case of PG&E, you see a line failure that results in catastrophic wildfire because of the risk of infrastructure failure in the West and also elsewhere has gotten a lot higher because we're seeing generally more periods of extreme drought and heat that make it so that forests simply aren't as healthy as they once were, making it so that a spark has the potential to create a fire with more potential to spread.
Hey guys, my name is Dom Rosso. I'm a Navy Special Operations veteran and owner and founder of the tactical company Crush Everything. I also train people in home defense, combatives, blade work, and advanced firearms training. Now I get to bring my years of experience to people who want answers to the world's most dangerous questions. Each week on my new Ironclad Original, I get to take calls from people about self-defense, my experience in combat, gear, life-threatening scenarios, and other important subjects. I'll also be breaking down real-world footage of violent situations to help you, the viewer, understand what to do when it all goes down. This season, we'll have the opportunity to bring in high-profile guests, host surprise appearances, and do cool giveaways and a whole lot more. Make sure you guys subscribe to Dangerous Questions, an Ironclad Original, on YouTube at This Is Ironclad, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, PG&E. So let's dial this into California. Can you explain to me, and for the listeners too, who is PG&E? What is PG&E? Where did they come from? And then we can jump right into the campfire in 2018. What happened and what was the actual human cost of that?
Yeah. So PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is the utility company serving almost all of Northern and Central California. It has service territory covering 70,000 square miles. Of course, well-known power provider to San Francisco and San Jose, but also lesser-known areas of the rural Sierra foothills, right, in Central Valley. And the company, it's more than 100 years old, came to be with the sort of race to develop hydroelectric power in the early 1900s. Pacific Gas and Electric Company formed in 1905. After there was a company, it was still a time in which power companies were competitive, right? So there was a bunch of little power companies competing to serve different areas, and a couple of pretty smart entrepreneurial guys created a company that bought up all of these competitors, not all of them. Had one competitor for a period of time called Great Western Power, the only real competitor PG&E ever had, built quite a bit of transmission infrastructure high up in the Sierra Nevada. And then the two companies merged in 1930, creating the great Northern California monopoly that we know today. Around that time, it became sort of conventional wisdom that utilities should be monopolies, given the right to operate exclusively in any given service territory in exchange for submitting to regulatory oversight. So that's sort of the history there. And it worked well for a period of time. But then, you know, a good lens through which to view how things can go wrong is the 2018 Camp Fire, which ignited when a hook on a century-old transmission tower in the Sierra foothills failed. It broke, it was a hook about the width of a fist. It broke nearly in half and dropped a live wire that swung against the metal tower. Sparks settled in the dry brush below, and within hours, a massive wildfire was blazing completely out of control. It destroyed the town of Paradise and several nearby towns and killed 84 people. And that hook that broke was original infrastructure from something like 1915-ish, purchased for 50 cents. And it had been built by Great Western, that one competitor that PG&E had back in the day. And, you know, with that acquisition, obviously, you know, records and stuff got lost and purged. And it's like when it came time to investigate the disaster, PG&E had very little records on this, on the origin of the infrastructure, for one, and also had very poor records as to what they had done to inspect and maintain the line over time. And it was just determined that over time, the company had done too much to reduce the frequency and thoroughness of its inspections up there. I mean, this is very remote infrastructure that's hard to access, but it was really becoming prone to failure, and they should have been doing more.
I was going to say, did they have any other close calls prior to the Camp Fire? I mean, something made in 1910, I can't think of a single item in my daily life that I use that even approximates something that old for a reason.
Yeah, so if we're talking just about transmission, which is, you know, sort of the, specifically the issue of the Camp Fire, right? The age of this high voltage network developed to, you know, carry hydropower way, way back in the day. When PG&E did a thorough inspection of that system in that region after the Camp Fire, it was determined that there was many, many other hazards that could pose similar risk. So it so happened that it was this disaster that revealed other problems on the transmission system. But there's another major risk category that PG&E grapples with, and that's the prospect of trees hitting lower voltage distribution wires. So wires that are closer to, you know, towns and cities and, you know, serve that directly serve your house. And in 2017, there was a massive windstorm. These sorts of winds happen every fall in California, in both the South and the North. In the North, they're called the Diablo winds. So the Diablo winds start to blow in October of 2017, and roughly 17 or 18 wildfires ignite as a result of branches touching PG&E's power lines. And that underscored the fact that the company needed to do much more to keep vegetation away from the wires. It hadn't been doing so effectively until that point. And so it's an unfortunate fact that, like, in this industry and others, it often takes a disaster to make the company aware of how short its efforts have fallen as it relates to risk management. But this is something that PG&E is still grappling with. As far as I'm aware, they've done more to make the transmission system safer, but this issue of distribution wires and trees is still very active.
That's actually an issue. I live in northwestern Montana. Mm-hmm. The timber here in areas is very dense. And actually, yeah. If I go outside from the building I'm in, you can see these very high power transmission lines. They cut the break in the forest as it travels the hills, and it goes in different directions. But we get windstorms here from time to time. And, you know, come August, September, October, there's been times where I can't even see a block down the street because of the smoke. And I would imagine it's very similar to, and for people not familiar, the Camp Fire was up north of Sacramento, I would say, in the foothills, actually up into the foothills. There's a lot of timber, very, very similar to where I am. It's an interesting issue. In the newer construction here, they've started burying power lines, which at least seems to insulate from the trees falling over, but the vast majority of the infrastructure in place is not new where I live. So I don't know how they plan tackling that.
Yeah, and you make a great point with this this idea of putting wires underground. because, so it's interesting, in Europe, actually, after World War II, there had to be a pretty massive rebuild of parts of the grid, right? And companies were smart to say, let's put this underground. I think at the time, of course, it was like, well, maybe it can't be taken out as easily next time, right? It wasn't necessarily so much a fire issue. But we never really had the opportunity in the US for that kind of like large scale rebuild. And so for that reason, in most parts of the US, distribution lines still run overhead. In some places, companies have selectively put it underground, but to kind of retrofit the system in that way is really expensive. And PG&E, so I'll just say in 2021, PG&E got a new CEO after these massive fires. The company ultimately went through a bankruptcy restructuring process. And she comes in with the intent of making things safe, right? This is sort of like going to be her legacy career move. And 6 months into her tenure, a little tree falls on the distribution line, not too far from where the campfire ignited, and ultimately the second largest wildfire in California history, spread throughout the foothills, covered more than 1 million acres. And in that moment, she sort of made an executive decision, and she went up to announce that the company was going to bury 10,000 miles of wire in the highest risk areas of fire. And wow, it's like that would be unprecedented within the U.S. utility industry. Could do a lot to reduce risk in those particular areas, because if the wire's underground, it has almost zero chance of igniting any sort of fire, but really expensive. Right now, it costs about $3 million a mile of wire, $3 million a mile. So we're talking, this is a, you know, at least a $20 billion undertaking at a time when California has had high electricity rates for a long time. And we're talking about having to do other upgrades to the system to support some of the state's goals as it relates to electric vehicle rollout and broader electrification. And there's other climate risks that the state is contending with. And so there was a real debate last year as PG&E was proposing its first tranche of work as to like how much is appropriate when you've had this other stuff that could put pressure on rates. And PG&E's argument is, you know, over the life of these power lines, it's cheaper to put it underground because we don't have to be spending billions of dollars keeping the trees away and doing other things like that. And I think that is true. But like this question is like, how much can you and me paying for electricity today be asked to bear to kind of ultimately benefit people like decades later? And so PG&E got approval to bury about 1,200 miles of wire over the next few years. And I think that they really want the opportunity to show that they can develop the economies of scale needed to do this more cheaply. But there's like a lot of questions that are in play as to how that's going to develop.
Yeah, the burying of the power lines specifically in that area would certainly help from a fire mitigation. But you bring up an interesting point. I left California in 2017 and we lived down in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rolling blackouts were not a term that I grew up with. In Santa Cruz. And then down mm-hmm. in San Diego, I started hearing terms about rolling blackouts, which I never dug incredibly deeply into it, but I assume, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's basically an issue of supply and demand. You know, demand at times was exceeding supply capacity. So they would, and I don't know how they would, but they would selectively choose areas that were going to receive power and those that were not. Rates were going up. You know, you mentioned the electric vehicle desire for the state of California, which I don't even know if the power grid, if we're still dealing with rolling blackouts and a supply and demand issue, I don't know how the implementation of electric vehicles into that power grid is going to play out given its current state. It is a very complicated issue. I hope you are enjoying season 2 of Change Agents, which is an Ironclad original. And if you are a fan of the podcast, you know that we are presented by Montana Knife Company, which from where I am sitting right now is a short 2-hour drive, maybe 120 miles due south towards Missoula. I was first exposed to this brand through its founder, Josh Smith. And actually, when I first met him, I wasn't even aware of what Montana Knife Company was. He sat across the table from me. We had a conversation, and I have been a fan ever since. This was a few years ago, and the velocity and trajectory of that company is unbelievable. I directly associate that growth with who Josh is, what he stands for, and what he puts into his product. So a little bit more about Josh. He's been making knives for 30 years. They're made in the USA. They have a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. They're design tested and they're built by hunters, and MKC's a hunting knife company first and foremost. They sell out their knives sometimes in under 60 seconds. And if you want to see what they have available or what's coming up, surf over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have a new knife drop every Thursday at 7 p.m. Here's what I'm going to say on that. Practice checking out. As ridiculous as that sounds, you need to have your credit card information loaded and practice the checkout process, because they go like that. I cannot even count the number of times I have had a knife taken from my cart because somebody was faster to purchase it than I was. People ask me all the time, what's my favorite blade of theirs? I go with the Mini Speed Goat. It is my everyday carry knife. I don't use it for knife fighting. I use it for things that I need a knife for, so usually opening boxes. But it is my favorite blade, and if you're a fan of working knives made for working people, I highly suggest that you check out Montana Knife Company. And I'm going to add to that. Let's talk a little bit about the warranty. They have the best warranty program in the industry. No matter if you bought the knife from them directly, or bought the knife from a friend, or it was gifted to you, or if you even found the knife, they're going to honor the warranty for the life of the blade. How awesome is that? Couldn't be more proud to have them as the presenting sponsor of Change Agents. They are a fantastic organization. Ladies and gentlemen, today's episode is also brought to you by Mountain Tough. It's a unique functional fitness program that is, of course, supported by hunters and SEALs and Rangers and those from the special operations community. But that is not my favorite part of the Mountain Tough system or program. Although it was developed with insights from the backcountry hunter and veteran special operations community, there is an emphasis on more than just physical strength, which I believe to be essential. It is also about building an unbreakable mind. It is easy to build muscles from the neck down. It is far more difficult to build muscles from the neck up and the resilience between your ears. The Mountain Tough app provides the best functional fitness program directly to your phone, tablet, TV, or a web browser. So you really don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know what I could be doing or should be doing, whether it's a program or inspiration or insight. It's all right there at the touch of your fingers. Some of you might be saying, well, I'm not a ex-special operations personnel. I'm also not a backcountry hunter. That's okay. For those of you who might not start out as an elite athlete, but you want to improve wherever you may be, Mountain Tough is determined to push everybody's limits. And they're going to meet you where you are with thoughtful programming, helping you achieve elite status through progressive fitness, focusing on longevity, injury prevention, and holistic development. It's a story arc from wherever you are, getting as close to elite as could possibly be. So what are you waiting for? You can join the global Mountain Tough community right now. A community of people transforming their lives, bodies, and minds. Download the Mountain Tough app today and start training to always be ready for whatever it is you're trying to be ready for the backcountry, for the mission, or just life's unexpected challenges. Because when it comes to being prepared, there's no excuse to not start now. You can use the code CHANGE, which I'm looking at all capital letters, one word, at mountaintough.com on the monthly plan to get your first month absolutely free after your 14-day free trial. That's 6 weeks free to dive in, test the waters, the programming, and make sure it's actually for you. What are you waiting for? You can change your life today. Be ready for the mountains, the mission, and just life in general. All right, so there's the infrastructure, supply, demand. And then last year, you wrote an article titled Power Grid Attacks Surge and Are Likely to Continue, which is there's the heat, the natural issues, climate change, there's the aging infrastructure. This to me sounds completely different though. This sounds like targeted attacks on infrastructure, which is of course not going to make anything any better or more manageable for people. So if you could unpack what that article was about and who you assess to be behind these attacks.
Sure. Well, there was a series of attacks in North Carolina, or at least one very prominent attack on a Duke Energy substation that resulted in significant blackouts. And, you know, attacks on energy infrastructure are not new. This has been a risk that the utility industry has been grappling with for a long time. So when you think about it, I mean, this stuff is very much exposed, right? I mean, a substation might have a fence around it, but it's not that hard to find, and it's not that hard to target with a long gun, you know? And it's usually a substation, I can't say this for certain, but a substation attack. There's been that's usually what sort of makes the news if you're talking about a targeted attack on electric infrastructure. And the industry has been trying to do more to safeguard these facilities, but to put a concrete dome over all these things, you can't do that, right? So it's there are several sort of regulatory bodies or quasi-regulatory bodies that are trying to do more to create standards by which utilities can work to make these things more hardened against these sorts of attacks. But I think the consensus is we live in a pretty politically polarized society. There's sort of interest among certain groups in who knows what, knocking out the power for all kinds of different weird political reasons. And that risk doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So fortunately, we haven't heard much since then, but there are also, of course, sort of folks in the national security realm who are trying to track chatter among those who might be planning these kinds of attacks. And it seems like that's become more of a full-time job lately, I think, if we just put it that way.
Yeah, I was looking at a stat here and it said, in 2013, snipers took out 17 transformers critical to supply power to Silicon Valley, which I was living in California at the time. I never heard anything about this. Do you know anything about that?
That was the Metcalf substation attack, right? Was that 2017? I thought that was a little earlier.
2013 says. It says 17 transformers in 2013.
Oh, 2013, yeah. So I think if I'm recalling correctly, that was a big PG&E transformer. I mean, that was like one of the most prominent attacks we've seen over the last 20 years. And I don't exactly know what the motive was. I don't quite know if it's possible that other people do and I don't. But it certainly underscored the fact that this can be very consequential. And the fact that utilities definitely need to do more to safeguard these substations. So it's sort of yet another risk layered on top of everything else we've been talking about.
Well, and it's I think what we're talking about so far is individuals with some mechanism. It sounds like it's probably a long rifle at a substation. I was just thinking as you were talking about that, how would you protect these? If you're not looking for them, I bet you most people drive by them every day and don't realize they're there. And again, where I live in
100%.
Where I live in rural Montana, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about my daily drive. Like, oh, I think I passed two of those. Mm-hmm. And they are completely in the open. That chain link fence is really just doing its national security job. Definitely a deterrent for nothing whatsoever. So yeah, and I don't know how you would protect that. But there's another layer of that. So you have environmental conditions. You have the aging infrastructure. You have the ability for people to interact with it from something with a long rifle. But then there's cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. What have you noticed when it comes to, and that one, this is actually the one that I think concerns me the most, because this could be, and maybe this is movie based, but this could be somebody sitting in their basement in a completely different country who has nothing but time on their hand and hatred for fill in the blank for whatever reason, having the ability to metaphorically throw the switch on a massive amount of the US population.
Yeah, so candidly, this is not a subject that I've done a ton of reporting on, but there's no question that this is there's massive cybersecurity risk. I mean, it only grows with time, as our technological capacity increases, right? It's just it could be anyone. I mean, not anyone, but it could be, it's becoming easier for someone without a great deal of, knowledge about specific aspects of the grid or whatever to inflict real harm. I mean, there's no question, and I can't really do much to quantify how that's changed over time. But I do have a colleague who I worked really closely with on some of the PG&E stuff, and it's really unfortunate that she retired fairly recently and then passed away. But she was doing a ton of work on some cybersecurity grid related stuff, and she didn't quite finish the project that she wanted to work on, but kind of the parting thoughts were this is a very big deal.
Do you have any understanding that it's not your direct purview, but do you have any understanding of how linked the power grids are, not only in California, but let's just say in the US, how intrinsically tied are they to technology? I mean, is there a human, I'm assuming it requires something other than a human being watching a meter, you know, like a vacuum meter going back and forth for supply and demand. But is it hard stopped by a human, or are we, do you think we're accelerating towards a place where it is completely technologically managed?
Oh, well, I mean, certainly, I mean, the systems used to track all different aspects of the power grid are tied into like computers.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there's when you go into like a control room, whether it be at a utility company or at the grid operator level, I mean, there's all kinds of programs and software used to track a lot of things and, you know, control output on power plants. And, you know, I mean, even just that in and of itself, if you're controlling the output of a power plant, like this plays into the sort of supply and demand issue that we were talking about earlier. I mean, to either like to have it just, you know, go totally offline unexpectedly or like multiple all at once, then all of a sudden, again, you're creating that like cascading failure issue that we were talking about. So, I mean, there's lots of ways in which this could be disrupted, like how easy that is based on like the way that the computers are used. I don't quite know, but it's not that hard to imagine.
That is, it's terrifying to me. I feel like we live with a thinner veneer of stability and security than most people would want to wrap their heads around. And I don't remember exactly where the quote comes from, but I do like the quote and I believe it to be true, but it essentially says that we're 9 meals away from anarchy at any given time, meaning 3 days of what if the power goes out. And you know, the first day you're going to be all right. Second day, things are coming off the edges a little bit. And then the third day, not that it would happen this fast, you know, neighbors are eating each other. I think that would probably take a little bit longer, but I don't know how much longer. And that's probably the biggest concern that I have, especially in areas. I love California, born and raised in California, but the subdivision that I lived in, quite frankly, has more people in it than the city that I live in now in northwestern Montana. They're spread out more. They're a little bit more self-reliant. I don't know what it would look like if the power went off legitimately for beyond that 3-day time period or pushed it into 9 or pushed it into a month. I worry as to whether or not our society would hold up very well.
If it was across the, I mean, there's been instances in which the power has been out for 3 or 4 days for large numbers of people and where it's like, it's been disastrous in many ways. We didn't like end up resorting to cannibalism, right? But it's like,
That's on the fourth day, you know, maybe the fifth day. It's hard to say.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, so there's been a number of instances for different reasons that we've seen in recent years when there's been several days without power. One of the most acute issues happened in 2021. Yeah, in Texas. And so we were talking about rolling blackouts earlier, supply demand issues. It was across the board failure for a number of different types of power plants. You're talking everything, coal, gas, nuclear plant froze, wind and solar went up and down, sometimes overperforming, sometimes underperforming. And the grid operator had to call for rolling blackouts, but because there was so little supply relative to demand, the blackouts couldn't roll, right? So like a utility company is not going to shut off a critical circuit serving a hospital. So they have the choices of sort of the discretionary circuits. They had to like choose all of them all at once. And so the power was out in Texas in sub-freezing temperatures for as long as 4 days in some places. And like, we didn't see like full scale collapse of society, but you did see people burning furniture in their homes, right? And like just doing other rash, radical things to try to survive. And more than 200 people died. Whether just because they froze or because there was some sort of issue with like running the car in the garage or whatever it might have been, you know, and it was terrifying, right? It's just like, it just underscores the fact that like how reliant we are on this infrastructure and the fact that it needs to function in order for us to live.
As Ironclad Originals launched a couple years ago, Dom was always on our short list of kicking things off. This has been the project that we've been looking to do for a while. This is Dave Ramsey meets John Rambo, where you get to call in and get answers to the most dangerous questions that you have.
What should I do if I hear shots ringing out? or what I should do if there's a major terrorist attack.
How is your faith tied in to being a protector?
Is there a moral case for taking a life?
What is your recommendation on critical EDC?
What should I have?
What's the best?
What should I do?
What does that look like?
What would you recommend?
Is there anything I could do?
All right, one more electricity question for you, then I got an off-the-wall one. You're queen for a day. Catherine is put into the seat, and you get to choose anything you want to, as far as, you know, maybe enhancing or improving or stabilizing the California power grid. What would your first move be?
I've never been asked this question. Does cost matter?
Sure. Actually, no, because this is a totally hypothetical situation. Let's just make the whole thing hypothetical. Cost is relevant.
It doesn't matter. Everything's free. if cost was no object, I'd put the power lines underground.
Yeah, that makes sense. What if cost was an object?
I think I'd speed up battery deployment.
Okay.
A bunch more batteries, and it would be much better for that and sort of making more localized power grids in some of these high risk areas, whether that be using batteries or whatever, so that hopefully more of these communities could stay online when the risk conditions are high. That's not a huge cost intensive thing, and it could be used to help.
All right, that makes sense. All right, we're going to do a complete 90-180 because they put this at the bottom of my briefing notes, and there's no way I'm not asking you about this. So you were part of a reporting team that found that Instagram's algorithms connect pedophiles and promote underage sex content. So for those of you who have been listening about electricity, stand by. We're taking a right-hand turn here for a second. The reporting actually led to Mark Zuckerberg being brought before Congress. Can you explain what your team found and how Meta, which for people who don't know, it owns Instagram, which this is a California company too, so I guess we're still staying in the boundaries of California.
Yeah. So
how could
we're talking about a reporting team? Big shout out to a reporter, Jeff Horowitz. He is our Meta reporter. He is really, really talented. I got brought in to assist with this investigation. It's obviously not my usual area of focus, but we are still talking about complex institutional problems here. And so Jeff is has done so much to expose a lot of problems within Meta. Some listeners may potentially remember this big package of work that the Wall Street Journal had called the Facebook Files, predicated on a whistleblower who was in touch with Jeff, Francis Haugen. And, you know, he wanted to sort of expand on this sort of idea of what does Meta's algorithms facilitate and what does Meta know about that? And of course, you know, issues with child sexual abuse material, child porn. I mean, that's very dark, very consequential. And what we discovered was that, you know, this is not a story about there's bad stuff on the internet, right? Like everyone knows that, like there's always going to be bad stuff on the internet. You can never fully eradicate it. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the fact that Instagram's algorithms basically make it so that if you are a user who demonstrates an interest in child porn, like it is going to help you find a lot of it. It's going to help you find other people who like it. It's going to help you find people who sell it. And the reason for that, in large part, is because the algorithm is very, very well trained to help people with niche interests find those interests. And so if we're talking about building ships and bottles, right? I create an Instagram account because I want to learn how to build ships and bottles. And I want to connect with other people who build ships and bottles, and I want to find people who will sell me the parts to build ships and bottles. It will do that for me. It'll do that because I click on one little thing that says, I like building ships and bottles. And with that, I'm giving the algorithm a really strong signal, right? So like, I'm in my 30s, I live in San Francisco, I like hiking and I like cooking and I like, you know, I like animal videos. You know, I like knowing what's happening in San Francisco. Like my profile on Instagram is like any other 30 something woman living in San Francisco. I'm not giving it any sort of strong signal whatsoever. It's just like, it's pretty generalized content. Whereas if I set up that new account, in the interest of, you know, pick another one, building model rockets, right? Like all of a sudden that whole account is going to be flooded with model rocket enthusiast stuff. And unfortunately, the same logic applies to people who demonstrate sexual interest in children. And that can look like finding truly illicit material. That can look like connecting those users to like child modeling accounts. There's a whole proliferation of the influencer economy, that kind of stuff. It can result in sort of the Reels video function, feeding these users like really weird Reels that are kind of like, it's not illegal, but it's really unsavory, kind of just, you know, it's a really dark world, and it's really the forces of the algorithm that make it almost unprecedentedly easy for users with this sort of interest to find that content.
What was Zuckerberg's explanation of that? It's a byproduct of an algorithm that is not designed to be used by that, but could be based off of your input.
Basically, and I think that generally speaking, and not just in relation to this particular issue, but others as well, there's been a real tension within the company because to sort of make it so that this isn't so affects collateral damage. Right. If I'm using it for the right reasons, then all of a sudden my experience is diminished. Certainly that has an effect on ad revenue, targeted ads, like that kind of stuff. And so the company's response to date has been like, let's build the technology to better weed out the bad actors, as opposed to make meaningful changes to the functionality of the algorithm in a way that's going to have ripple effects throughout the entire platform.
The complicated problem. I wonder sometimes how well they even understand their own algorithm. I mean, it works. I know this because sometimes I swear I just have thoughts and then I see an ad for the thing that I absolutely don't need, but I was thinking about.
Or you say, you know, you say a brand and all of a sudden a brand has populated your account. Yeah.
Yeah. To Instagram and then onto Facebook. And then the next thing you know, it's showing up in a YouTube ad. It is, I can only imagine, so complex. I wonder how many people truly at a deep level understand the mechanism of how it works.
Well, I can tell you there's been instances in which Jeff has shown that he understands it better. But yeah. Then there's other instances in which staffers, whether safety staffers or others, have done deep dives, kind of recognized something is wrong and studied the way that it works and then escalated it to higher levels. And that's where things kind of start to break down.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, if the power goes out in California because the grid fails, eventually so will the smartphones. And I guess it could solve both problems.
you could definitely make that argument.
I'm not saying I want that to happen, but I'm just trying to put a rosy bow on this topic because, I mean, if it doesn't scare the shit out of you, I think you're not paying attention, both on the social media front, but also the power grid front. I truly do believe that the veneer that we live, security and safety, is a lot thinner than most people think.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll give you the final words. What would you like to close it out with now that we've terrified everyone? I'll leave it up. We can scare them more, or you can leave them with a message of hope. It's up to you.
Well, I'm going to leave with a practical note, right? So I think for a long time, we took for granted that the lights would go on reliably and safely, right? That was just sort of to have something else happen was sort of the exception, not the rule, right? Whereas now we're moving into a time in which there's major safety issues, there's major reliability issues of the grid. I think everyone's thinking about the grid in a way that they haven't had to before. Doesn't necessarily mean everyone necessarily understands it better. But I will say, like, there are ways to learn, for one. It's like one thing that really enthuses me as a journalist is trying to help people understand these problems, right? Because they're pretty complex, but they really affect you. I wrote a book about PG&E, but it's more than about PG&E. It's really about utility companies all across the country. And, you know, as like tedious as this may sound, the regulatory process is participatory. You know, it's like, if you understand what's going on, like you can weigh in on like, what should these companies do to make it safer? You can submit public comment, you know, you can go to hearings. I realize that not everyone has the time and the resources to do that, but there are people that do, and you can like kind of coordinate with those people in your community. Like, this is something that it doesn't necessarily have to happen in these dark halls with no public input as it has for a very long time. It's something that like more people are getting active. And I think that like, you know, if you understand what's going on, you have the potential to have a voice as well.
I love it. That's a perfect ending. Catherine, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
Really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to learn more about Catherine's reporting on PG&E, you can read California Burning, and you can also visit her website at www.catherineblunt.com. That'll be down in the show notes. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original, proudly presented by Montana Knife Company. We'll see you next week with an all-new episode.
All right, guys, check this out. This new Ironclad original series, Dangerous Questions. I'm Dom Rosso, and I am so fired up about this series because I've been wanting to do something like this for a long time. This series is really about you and about the challenging and uncomfortable questions that you've been afraid to ask. We're gonna dive into topics like home defense, self-defense, travel, combatives. We are gonna cover so many different topics. And again, the best part is I get to do it with you guys and we get to learn together. We're gonna be able to do live video call-ins. You guys can write your answers in. You can leave comments. We are gonna look at them all. One of my favorite parts about the series is that we get to break down real life scenarios and videos to analyze them, to learn from them, and take away value to apply to your own life. This series is dropping on April 26th, and I cannot wait. Make sure you send in your questions, and I'll see you guys soon.